Good afternoon. Last time, we sort of went over very, very broadly the sort of topics we'll be covering this semester, and also went over some logistical issues. And then we did a bit of what I hope is review of C with a few examples, particularly focused on pointers, because that's the part of C which, in my experience, causes people the most problems later on in this course. Sort of have a reminder of pointer arithmetic, that you have pointer plus a number, it advances the pointer by number elements as if it was an array that it pointed to. And we have our array indexing syntax, which kind of pretends the pointer is the beginning of an array, and therefore uses that. And kind of a reminder that when we have a star, that follows kind of one level of indirection. It doesn't take any smarts about figuring out, oh, there really should be another one here. It just does that, and if it doesn't match up, you're getting the wrong value. And also, we saw this kind of sort of pattern where we had this idea of passing a pointer to a function in place of having the function return a value. And something we wanted to be clear about is sort of what happens to the arguments here. And the arguments, the functions in C, are copied. For a pointer, well, we're copying an address. So the address still points to the same place. That's why this works for returning a value, but we actually have two kind of independent copies of the address when we do this. So questions about these things we covered last time? Make sure I look at the whole room. Okay. And I want to give a note because I'm worried I kind of glossed over something last time. So in one of the exercises we had this piece of code here, which we said had this type error, that we had a singly dereference pointer to int, which is a pointer to int, because we dereferenced it once. And we had this element in the int array, which is an int. And we said, oh, well, we're assigning a pointer to an int. And I may have implied that that's a compilation error, because I'm used to it being a compilation error, because I turned the default warning about converting a pointer to an integer to an error, because it's almost always an actual problem that's going to cause me a problem. But technically, if you use Clang or CGCC and you don't do that, it's just a warning that's on by default that you shouldn't ignore, because probably you didn't mean to do this. So questions on? Okay. So when we finished up last time, we were talking about building C programs, which is going to be our primary topic today, is building programs and some automation for doing this. And the process that we've talked about before is that, well, when we're building an executable in this case, we're kind of building it from two source files that contain C code, and there's also a few associated header files. And typically, when we write programs, we use some functions that we didn't write, like, say, printf. And those are going to be declared in header files that we didn't write, that are supplied by the system. We're not going to, like, have our own copy of standard A.H. And they're going to have some implementation in system files that we didn't write. And also, it turns out that if we look at what actually happens on Linux and most systems, main isn't actually where your program starts. There's some code that's part of the standard library that runs first. So that's in files that are supplied by the compiler in the system. So we have this process where we can do this compilation, not as sort of one giant process, and it doesn't actually happen sort of all together. We do it in these separate steps. And we have this step where we take our C file, and the compiler looks at it. Processes the include, so when we read the C file, it also reads the .h files it includes, and it turns that into what we call an object file. And we hopefully learn in CS01 that actually there's kind of a hidden step here, where when we do that, we can actually generate this assembly file, which is kind of human readable, you know, and that then gets turned into an object file, which is not human readable. It's in a form that's close to being ready to put in the executable. And since we compile multiple C files, we get separate object files for each one, and we somehow combine those together along with our system files, which contain some code that goes in our executable that we didn't write, and that makes our executable program. And on these slides, I have some kind of commands that represent each step. So this making these .o files, we can do with clang or gcc with the -c for compile only option. We can create the assembly files with -s, capital S, to stop at assembling. And we can combine the .o files kind of with the default mode is to produce an executable. If I give it .o files, it's gonna produce it from the .o files, meaning that, well, the C to .o step has already been done. And something that's shown on this diagram, which might be a bit surprising, is that when I get this program, even though I included some system files, we have this extra file that is loaded at runtime. So when I run my program that uses things like printf, the default way that things work is that printf isn't actually in that program that clang produced earlier. Instead, when that program runs, as it starts up, it opens this other file, which on Linux is called libc.so, that contains the code for printf and functions like that, and loads it as the program runs, meaning that if I update libc.so, I can get a different implementation of printf. And this idea of loading at runtime, this is called dynamic linking. And so linking generally is this process of taking our sort of multiple compiled files and putting them together into a program. And what's happening here is we have sort of some static linking to make our executable. And then we have some dynamic linking where we're doing some of the linking as the program starts. We're combining other files on the system with our program to make a single program we can run as the program starts. Okay, so questions? Let's set up here. So I mentioned that this sort of approach where we have our sort of system functions like printf and so on loaded at runtime, that's kind of the default. We can also do this in a way where that doesn't happen. This is called static linking. So in this case, we're going to have our code for things like printf and so on be put into the executable itself. And with GCC or clang, the way we do sort of this step here is we'd say clang minus static minus O program. And we give the same main.o and extra.o. And in this case, our executable actually contains a copy of printf and all those functions rather than loading it at run. Both of these are options, but the default is generally to use dynamic linking on every system you're used to. But you can choose to use static linking, and if you look at real programs that are out there, you'll see a mix of these choices. So questions on this static linking scenario? Okay, so in this kind of set scenarios we've come up with, we have kind of different types of files which are identified by extensions. I've kind of shown the most common extensions for these types of files on Linux. So we have what you should all be familiar with, .c and .h files, so C source files and header files. We have assembly files, which on Linux are usually .s. You might see other extensions elsewhere, .asm, other things. We have object files, which on Linux are traditionally .o. You might see .obj or some other extensions elsewhere. And we have executable files, which by convention on Linux have no extension. You might see .exe on Windows, for example, and other ideas elsewhere. And we also have these libraries. So we could distribute kind of the copies of printf and all these functions we want to use, or other functions we want to use that other people have written, as a bunch of .o files for us to use. But usually, instead, we want to like have something that sort of combines a whole bunch of .o files and maybe is in a form more ready for the compiler and linker and the program as it starts to use. So we have different formats for that. And there's two kind of different ones, depending on whether we're doing static linking, that is, we're putting the library in the program itself, we're copying the code there, or dynamic linking, meaning when the program starts, it's going to load it from another file. And on Linux, our statically linked libraries are .a, and .a files are literally an archive, like a zip file, not actually zip, but a different format, of .o files with an index on Linux. And we also have dynamically linked libraries, which on Linux are .so for shared object. And these are processed more to be efficient to load as a program starts. And you'll see other equivalents of these in other OSs. So on Windows, statically linked libraries, I don't know what the format is, but they usually have the extension .lib. And dynamically linked libraries have the extension .dll for dynamically linked library. And on OS X, you'll see dynamically linked libraries are often .dylib or .framework or some other things like that. So, because no one's really agreed on what to name the files. But they're all kind of the same thing. The details are slightly different. Questions about our various extensions here? So talk about, since you probably haven't used or produced libraries, that's something we want you to know how to do. So we'll talk about how that works on Linux. You have to look up something similar to this but related on other systems. So on Linux, static libraries are created using, in most Unix systems I should say, static libraries are created using the AR program, which is an ancient, stands for archive, because this used to be a general purpose archive tool. It's not really used that way anymore, but that's what it comes from. And you can look up its man page for what all the options means, but kind of the default way is RCS for create an update with an index, a file that we want to contain .o files, basically. And then when you want to use this library, when you're making your executable, so when we're making a program called program, we say we want to use the foo library. And traditionally, the way we do this is we don't write libfoo.a in the path to it. We instead use this dash l, and we give the name of our library. And by convention, we'll say that this is the foo library, but we'll call the library file libfoo.a. And you've probably used this without realizing what was going on, this kind of syntax, when you used dash lm, which uses the m library, which is traditionally the math library that you may have used in the past. Now, if libfoo.a is not in a well-known location, we have to tell the compiler where do we look for it. So the compiler has some default places it looks for libraries, like ones that are installed for everything on the system, but if it's not there, we can use this dash capital L option to add a different new location to search for libraries. And basically every time I use the dash lowercase l option, it will look in all the default locations plus all the locations we specify with dash capital L for the lib whatever dot a file. Some questions? Right here. Yes, back there. Question, did I say the library's libfoo, but I just write foo? Yes. So basically, the compiler will take this foo here and put lib, then put the foo in there, and then put the extension, in this case, .a. As we'll learn later, we'll also look for .so. Question, all library files have to start with lib. It is not required, but if you want to use this syntax, which most libraries are designed to use, and I would recommend, they have to. You would have to ask the compiler to include the library in the program in a different way if they don't have that sort of name, like by supplying the full path to it, which is not what sort of the intended design is. Yeah, question, follow up? Does the dash L do that? The dash L option, yeah. The dash L option does the searching for lib something. Yes. Yeah.
Is program an object
file? Is program an object file? Program is an executable file. Often that will have a very similar format to an object file. But, you know, the idea is in this case that program is something we could run from the command line. Yes?
So program is like a.out.
So program is like a.out, yes. So actually what's going on here is that the dash O option doesn't say make an executable. It says change the name of the output file you're making. So if I removed the dash O program, it would actually create a.out literally. And the dash O file is just saying, instead of using the default name you'd use program. And this means, for example, if we go back to like this command here, right? This command creates main, or probably I'll use this example. This command here creates main.o. If I could do something like clang minus c main.c minus o foo and create main.o but in a file called foo. It's still an object file that's from main. It's not an executable, I just changed its name. That's all the .o minus o flag does. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry, can you repeat what the RCS was when you created
that? Can I repeat what the RCS was? So this is create and update with an index. And you can look this up in the man page, but for the most part, you just there's a pattern you use to make libraries, and that's going to be good enough. Yeah?
What did dash C dash O
do? Sorry?
What does dash C and dash O do?
What does dash C and dash O? So, the dash C says compile only. Only. And dash O says choose the output file name. Name to the thing you put after dash. Yeah?
So that whole thing, is RCS a flag, or is it?
So question is, RCS a flag in this AR command? So for horrible historical reasons, the syntax of the AR command is that it has AR, some letters, and then the rest of the options. And it doesn't take flags in the traditional sense. And the letters specify the mode of operation. It turns out that modern versions of AR also support specifying these options via flags. I'm not showing that because I'm showing something that's more portable. And you're more likely to come across in like old C projects. That answer your question?
Yes.
I thought I had a question back there. Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
The format of the object files in the archive, do they have to all be called the same thing with an index after, or does it just have to have like a number at the end of it? Like,
what's the format of the object files in the archive? Is your question?
Yeah, does it doesn't matter.
I don't know the details of how sort of the index for the archive works, but the idea is that it's something that's efficient to use, like if I need to find printf in the library. And it probably varies between systems. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
What's the difference between using a static library versus a dynamic library? Is it just like the coder's choice, or is it?
Question, what's the difference between using a static library and a dynamic library? Okay, so I guess there's some differences which should be apparent from what we've seen here. So one is that when we have a static library, all of our library's code ends up in the executable. This means our executable is going to be bigger. Another difference, which can be kind of apparent here, is that because with a dynamic library, if I change the dynamic library file, I change our code. So if I want to upgrade all the printf for all the programs on the system, if they use dynamic linking, really easy. If they use static linking, I have to relink all of those programs. As for, and you also asked sort of when you would use each one. So like probably the biggest reason to use static linking in practice is that if you want your executable's behavior to not change based on other things on the system, well, static linking is going to make that more likely because everything's in your executable, if other files change, is not going to change what the library functions in your executable are. So you'll often see commercial software will prioritize doing static linking for this reason, or they will do something funny with how they do dynamic linking to limit the impact of other files in the system being not what they expect. The big advantage with dynamic linking, the reason why it's default, is that like makes the file smaller. It's so it's probably a little slower than static linking can be, but the system can do things like only have one copy of the printf function loaded for all the programs, which is not something you can really do with static linking. So it can be more efficient in some senses, even though it's probably less efficient in others, in that, yes, there is work to do when the program starts that statically linked programs might not have. And also, it turns out, some work to do, like calling functions in dynamically linked libraries can be slow, a little bit slower, like teeny little bit. Okay. Other questions on that? Okay, so we showed creating static libraries, and we'll talk about creating shared libraries. So to create shared libraries, there's not a separate command like AR. It's done with your compiler, generally. So you compile your .o files, and there's something special you have to do in this step, in that you have to compile them in a different way so they can be used as part of a shared library. And the reason for this is that shared libraries can be loaded anywhere in memory, on at least on Unix systems. That's something that we have to allow. And that's not the default way things are compiled. So to allow that, you compile on Linux at least with -fpic for position independent code, meaning write assembly that can be loaded anywhere in memory. And this assembly might be very slightly slower than the default assembly. And then you can create a library by using the -shared option to your compiler. And otherwise, it's like you're creating an executable, but instead, with that shared, you're creating a shared library file. And then you use the library by specifying, you know, where to look for it and the name here. And like with our static libraries, we'll supply foo here, but it's going to look for libfoo. In this case, so for shared library. So questions? Here. Yes, back there.
Is it like three different lines of code? That says first compilation, and then what modification to .so, and then the final program?
So, question is, I'm talking about three different commands here. Yes, and I would say these are the commands that the library author is doing. And these are the commands the library user is doing. And we had those commands with static libraries too. I didn't show the .o creation commands because they were the same as for executables with static libraries. They just aren't with shared libraries. And then we had the AR command for static libraries. This -shared compilation compiler command replaces that with shared libraries. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
What's the difference between a shared library and an archive?
What's the difference between a shared library and a static library? The shared library is going to be set up, so we're going to load it as the program runs. The static library is going to be included in the executable.
Yeah, so the shared ones and the dynamic ones?
Shared ones and the dynamic ones, yes. So shared and dynamic are, for our purposes, interchangeable. The reason you see shared used is because, well, first of all, it can be shared between multiple programs, and secondly, in practice, like, the system can only load, can load just one copy of the library for all the programs that are running using it. Other questions? So something that is a sort of non-intuitive thing with shared libraries and looking for them is that I told you this L option is how we tell the compiler where to look for the library. And it is. But there's actually two things which need to know where libfoo.so is. One is the compiler, when it's making the executable, that's going to use libfoo.so. But another is the program that it actually runs. And where we look for libfoo.so in both each of these cases is set in different places. So this only sets where the compiler looks. It doesn't set where the program that's generated looks. So this means, for example, let's say here I have a library file I've created. I have the example library, so I've made it libexample.so. This isn't meant to be dynamically loaded. And I have main.c, and I'm going to compile main.c into an executable called main. I've skipped the step of making main.o, but that's going to happen under the hood because Clang is going to do some, you know, it's going to make main.c into main.s, and then main.s into main.o, and then main.o into the executable main, and it's going to get rid of the temporary files in the middle for us, but they're happening under the hood. So if I just try to do this normally, Clang is going to complain when it runs the linker program, which is what actually produces the executable from the object files, that, oh, we couldn't find L example. We don't know what that library is. That's because, well, I need to tell it where to look for it. So I did that. I said, it's in the current directory, dot. Look for libraries there, and then it finds it, and it makes my main program. Then when I try to run it, it says, the main program, I created it, but the main program can't find libexample because it's still looking for it in only the default locations. The dash capital L flag doesn't change where the program looks for things when it runs, it just changes where the compiler looks for things when it makes the program. So if you actually want to use this library, we have kind of two different ways we can deal with this. So one way is that there's a setting in an environment variable. This is kind of a key value pair that's kept with your shell and programs that it runs that defines where to look for libraries in addition to the standard system locations when we run programs. But on Linux, this is called LD library path. So I can say, have LD library path, have dot in it, and it's going to look for in dot in addition to the system locations for libraries, and then my program will actually load libexample. The other thing I can do is I can, there should be a comma here, is I can supply an option to the linking step to include an additional path to look for libraries in the executable. And a way I can do this on Linux is passing this WL minus rpath dot option. I have to look this sort of thing up when I use it. Basically what this means is that this is a WL means pass to the linker, which is the program the compiler runs to make executables, the following option, and the option we're passing to the linker is dash rpath dot, and rpath means runtime path for library searching. And this rpath option will embed in the executable, you know, it will change the code that loads libraries to look in an additional place in addition to the default locations. Okay, so questions on this library finding? Yes?
So, like you're saying, we don't have to do this obviously for the one word link after the call. We don't have to do this for the stack.
We don't have to do this for the static ones because there's nothing to do at runtime. We've already included all the code.
So we do this with the shared one. Do we also do it with the dynamic one, or do we do it separately?
Do we also do it with the
dynamic?
So sorry, dynamic and shared are the same thing. I probably should be more careful and only use one of the terms. I'm sorry, this is a note for the future for me. Yeah, but dynamic and shared libraries mean the same thing as far as we're concerned. Other questions? Okay, so that's on using libraries. So we've gone over to use libraries, and our next topic is going to be about sort of compiling things. And a big thing we're going to be concerned about with compiling things is avoiding doing too much work. So something we could do, so let's say here I have my program main.c and extra.c and some header files. I could, every time I went to compile this program, I could run one command, clang minus o program main.c extra.c. I could do that every single time I want to update anything in this program, but that's wasteful if I've only edited some of the files that are part of the program source. And we're going to talk about what do we actually need to do, and then how can we automate only doing what we actually need to do. And this is important if we think of compiling a big software project. So for example, like Firefox is, you know, has in it millions of lines of code. If I want to edit one thing in Firefox, I would probably literally have to wait like an hour to recompile absolutely everything. So we don't want to do that. We only want to change what we need to for these big software projects. So applying that, we have sort of two questions here. So if I change main.c, what each of these three commands do I need to rerun to handle those changes? And the same thing for extra.h. And give you some questions. So I'll give everyone time to think of the answers, but if you have questions about the question, let me know. But otherwise, take like a minute, check with your neighbors, see if you agree what the answers for each of those two cases will be. We'll take a show of hands. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's do a show of hands. So let's start with if main.c changes, who thinks we need to rerun command 1? Okay, who thinks we need to rerun command 2? Thinks we need to rerun command 3? Okay, good. We have pretty close to consensus that we need to rerun 1 and 3 if main.c changes. And that's what I read. So main.c, sort of a way I like reasoning about this is looking at this kind of diagram, and I can say main.c changed, that change is going to propagate to main.o, and if main.o changes, we better change the things that depend on it, which is program itself. And so we have the command that produced main.o and the command that produced program. Command that produced main.o is command 1. The command that produced program is command 3. We need to run both of those. And ideally, we should run 1, then 3. We better not run 3, then 1. That's not going to help us. Okay. So questions on that answer? Yes, back there.
Can you repeat, is there always a .o of what a .c file is?
Question, is there always a .o of what a .c file is? So one's always created, but we might not sort of save a copy, right? So if I was instead compiling with this command where I don't have, where I just take .c files to the program, quote unquote, directly, there's a .o file, but it's going to be in a temporary directory and deleted when the program is made. If we're using this clang minus c or gcc minus c op command, then we're telling the compiler to only do the .o creation step and save that file. So there will be a .o file in that case. And this is what we want to do if we want to be able to run as few commands as possible when things change, or sort of not run as few commands as possible, but do as little work as possible when things change. So for example, in this case, extra.c, I didn't change, so I didn't actually need to recompile it at all. Whereas if I was doing the approach of going from the .c files to program in one command, that would have happened. Extra.c would have been compiled again, wasting our time. Does that answer your question? Yes.
What's the main difference between .o and .exe?
Question, what's the main difference between .o and .exe? So an executable file is ready to be run. A .o file is not. A .o file is the representation of an assembly file, but it's not. We don't know where we're going to start running it, for example, yet. We don't have all the pieces that we might need to run it, like standard library files and things like that. It's just taking an assembly file and turning it into something that has all the assembly converted to machine code and things like that, but it's not quite ready to run yet. And mostly because we don't have all the code that needs to go into the executable. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so then we have the second question. If extra.h changes, which commands do we need to run? So who thinks we should run command 1 if extra.h changes? Okay. Who thinks we should run command 2 if extra.h changes? Who thinks we should run command 3 if extra.h changes? So we have a plurality saying all 3, but less consensus on this. I think all 3 is the right thing to do here. And this is less obvious because if you look at the commands, extra.h doesn't actually appear anywhere there. But it turns out that when we run command 1, this reads main.c and extra.h and standard.io.h, and we run command 2, this reads extra.c and extra.h and standard.io.h. And the reason it does that is not because, if we're compiling something called main, we always use extra.h. It's because there's an include statement that loads these extra files. These other files. So, we can't just tell from the file names this way. We have to use this kind of information here about what was included, you know, pound included in those files. But because extra.h was read, the result of the compilation, like the assembly file we get, could have changed based on how extra.h changed. Like if we changed a function prototype, that might change how the function is called. That changes a bunch of assembly in main and the function itself in extra.c, and therefore we have to generate, you know, different object files. Yes?
So, and does it matter which order you run 1 and 2 in? If you just change extra.h?
Question, does it matter which order you run 1 and 2 in? No. Other questions? Yes, back there.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I have this right, but if extra.h is part of a, like a dynamic library, then if we compile again, we don't need to run command three, right?
If extra.h is part of a dynamic library, if we compile again, we won't need to run command three. That is not correct, because extra.h, so is that you would say, when you say part of a dynamic library, what you really mean that is the declarations for things that are implemented in a dynamic library. But the thing is that what we change in extra.h not only might change the, so I guess we assume extra.h doesn't contain real code, right? That's your assumption. So one issue here is that that's not always true. Sometimes .h files contain code. There's ways of doing that that you will see used in practice. Even if it doesn't, even if it only contains function declarations, we change one of those function declarations, we're going to change how the function is called, which means that we're going to change the code that calls that function sometimes, and we're going to change the code in the function that gets its arguments and returns its return value and so on. And so that's going to affect both the things that call the functions and the things that, you know, implement the functions themselves. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we've figured out how to do this manually, but we want to, especially for large software projects, automate this process. And we're going to talk about a tool that's one of the oldest tools and works similarly to more recent tools for this thing, for basically automating this idea of, I changed a bunch of files, let's rerun the commands we have to rerun and not rerun things we don't have to do. This is a program called Make for doing this. And the way it does this is that it's actually very generic. It doesn't actually care that we're writing C and we have header files. It's going to follow rules we specify that we could write for kind of basically any programming language or things we want in a what's called a make file, which is going to be a text file that we create to sort of tell it what commands we want to run in a file called makefile with a capital M or not a capital M that has no extension. So that's the name of the file. I didn't omit .txt. It's a text file called makefile or, you know, capital M makefile without anything else in the name. So what are these rules? So this is kind of an example of a simple rule. So I'm going to go through each of the pieces here. So before the colon, we have what's called the target of the rule. This is the file that is created by this rule. So in this case, we're saying that this rule makes the file main.o. And after this colon, we have a list of the prerequisites of the rule. So these are the files that main.o is created from, and this means that if any of these files gets updated, we need to recreate main.o to update main.o. Then we have to know, well, if we want to make main.o, what commands do we run? And we have a list of commands which are prefixed by a tab character. And one of the unfortunate things about make being an old utility is that this has to be a real tab character. It cannot be 8 spaces or 4 spaces. It has to be an actual tab character, which some cases you might need to explore how to set your editor to actually do that, because make will complain and not work if you just put white spaces there. It needs to be literally a tab that is not converted to multiple spaces. But after that, we have these commands to run, and basically the make program is going to run these commands when files have changed, such that it's something that the rule, that the prerequisites and the target basically say should happen. And the way make is going to figure all this out is going to look at the modification times of the files. So when make runs, if we want to make sure main.o is updated, it's going to check when was main.o modified, when was main.c modified, when was main.h modified, when was extra.h modified. And if main.o is older than any of the files that are its prerequisites, it's going to run this command. So questions, this rule, yes. So question, what would happen if there's no prerequisites? In that case, if we're asking it to update main.o, it will still run the command if main.o doesn't exist. Otherwise, it will think main.o is up to date and not do anything. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yes?
Is the main.o the actual target created, or is it just a name for the
question, is the main.o the actual target created? So make is going to look for a file name main.o when it runs. Now, let's say I lied to make, and even though my command in this case will create a file main.o, let's say I tell main that this makes the file, primary.o. I lie to make and say, this is the command you run to make primary.o. In that case, make doesn't know how C compilers work, so it's just going to run that command, and primary.o won't be updated, so it will run that command every time, saying, primary.o doesn't exist, I have to run this command to create it, even though it never gets created. It's just going to run that command blindly, even though it's not helping. Does that answer your question? Question, if I specify an O flag? If I specify an O flag that is different, yeah, make won't pick up on that. So make runs these commands, it doesn't know anything about what the commands do. So if what you specify in the rule with the target and the prerequisites disagrees with the commands you're running, make's not going to know this, it's just going to check the modification times of those files and run the commands, even though the commands might not agree with that. So other questions? Yes, back there. Can I put other command line commands in there? Yes, you can have multiple lines of commands, each prefixed by a tab. And make will run each of them one after the other, basically. Other questions? Yeah.
Is it specifically one tab, or can it be any sort of consistent spacing?
Is it specifically one tab, or can it be any sort of consistent spacing? It's specifically one tab. You can have additional white space, because if you're in your command line and you type ls or space ls, they do the same thing. But make looks for one tab for the start of a command. Other questions? Yeah.
I got a little confused. Is the make file make.txt?
The make file is called literally make file, one word, as I have spelled it here or here with that capitalization. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
So it's like the flow of it. When you go ahead and run make, it checks main.o to see if any of the prerequisites have been modified, and then so it runs with command.
Question, when I run make, it checks main.o to see if any of those prerequisites have been modified, and if so, runs the command? Essentially, yes. Now, we'll have to talk a little bit about how this works when there's multiple rules, but that's essentially what will happen if main.o is selected by that procedure. That answer your question? Okay, back there.
So the main.o file won't update unless that
the regular O file will update unless that rule's read. We'll talk later about how we tell make what things we want it, what rules we want it to handle in a sec. But so far I've only shown you one rule, and that conversation isn't meaningful unless there's multiple rules, of course. Yeah. So the question is, if I run it the first time and I change main.c, it won't update unless I run it again? Yes. So make only runs when you run the make command. This command called make. We don't run it. It's not like looking in the background to see what's happening. We have to actually run it explicitly. Yes. Question, can I define where make will produce files? Make is literally running these commands in the command line, so wherever those commands put the files, that's where they'll end up. Yeah? What's the difference between manually running these commands versus running the make utility that will use these rules? Well, the make utility will decide which one of those commands to run and the order to run it in based on the prerequisites. We'll see some examples of that later. So, yeah.
One last question. Can you define where make will find its prerequisites? So can you have main.c in a different directory and still be able to
report? Question, could I have main.c in a different directory? If I want to do that, I could do something like other/main.c, right? The same way you specify that like in a command, right? That answer your question? Yeah, the files don't have to be in the current directory, but you have to provide the correct path to them. Like you could use with, say, ls to get the, or like your text editor to open the file. Okay, so we can typically, we'll have a make file, we'll have multiple rules. So in this case, I have a rule for producing program for my .o files, I have a rule for producing for each of my .o files. And we'll have told make to produce one of these targets. So most often, if I have this make file, I'll ask make to make the program target. And make's gonna figure out, this make program is gonna figure out, oh, for that I need main.o and extra.o. Let's see if those are up to date. And it's gonna check each of them and run all the acceptable commands, and it's gonna know from the prerequisites that, oh, I have to make main.o before I run make program, run the command to put program together, because one depends on the other. So we'll typically have a make file with multiple rules like this. And you might say, how do we specify which rules we do? And when we run the command make, which is going to read this make file, we can say make, and we can specify a particular target. So that would be anything that's on the left-hand side of one of these rules, on the left-hand side of the colon. And it's going to make sure that target is up to date, running any commands needed to do that, including any sort of following the prerequisites as far as it needs to, just recursing until it gets to the end. We can specify multiple targets. And very often, you'll just run make without anything. And it's going to look for the first target, so it just looks at the first rule and uses that one, and tries to make sure that's up to date. And that behavior of looking at the first rule is why when I wrote this sort of example here, I put program at the top, because that's probably what I want to be the default, is updating program, not any of the single .o files. So questions? Here. Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have this make file and I run make w. And I have these modification times for files. One of the files doesn't exist. What commands will run? Who would like some more time? A couple people. Too many. Okay. So I guess it's quite. So let's do. So who thinks A? None of the no commands get wrong. Two people. Okay. B. C. D. E. F. G. No clue. Okay. So we have a plurality for E and a mix of other answers and no clue. So let me do, I have a prepared explanation of what goes on here. So I've kind of drawn a picture of what those make rules represent, that we have W, which depends on X and Y, and X depends on Q, Y depends on X and Z. So to make W, which is what we're asking you to do, we need to make sure X and Y are up to date first. So the make file, make is gonna recurse to do this. So we're gonna go to check if X is up to date, and we look at X and we say, oh gosh, well X depends on Y and Y doesn't exist. So we have, well X depends on Y, so we have to check and Q. So we first have to check if Y is up to date, and we find out Y, Y doesn't exist, and Z is 3 hours old. Y is not up to date, it doesn't exist. We need to get it up to date, so we're always gonna build Y first. We're gonna kind of make sure all the prerequisites are up to date, and in this process we find out Y isn't up to date because it doesn't exist, therefore I need to build it. So we're gonna run the command to build Y, and we're gonna do this order wrong? Yeah, to build Y, oh, I have this order wrong, yes, sorry. Y depends on X, so we're gonna say Y doesn't exist, so we need to build it. And to build Y, we need to build X. X is older than Q, so first thing we need to do is update X. So we're gonna update X, run the command build X, then we update Y, and since we just updated X and Y, it's gonna churn out when we finally get to processing W, we need to build W again. Because now it's, even though it's only 1 minute old, it is now older than the things it depends on. So questions about, come with this answer, yes. So the question, if the file we found is more recently changed than the prerequisites, then this command is not run. So there's two parts of that. So one is that we have to think of, if it doesn't exist, what do we consider that? But more importantly here, we first, when we check the prerequisites, the first thing we do is make sure the prerequisites are up to date first. So the process of building W is step one, is make sure X is up to date. Step two is make sure Y is up to date. Only after we do that process do we check the modification times. So at the time we're checking whether we want to build W, we've just updated X and Y, so it is not newer. Yeah?
What's the point of checking W's edit time then if you always are going to update X and Y?
Question, what's the point of checking W's edit time? So let's say if we had a starting situation where instead of Y being Y and X being non-existent, if, say, Y and X were up to date, that doesn't mean W is up to date. If, like, say, W was older than them, like, say, W was, like, 1 day old, right? It could be the case X and Y are up to date, but we still need to build W. Does that answer your question? So the question is, when do we consider files that do not exist? I believe generally they're just considered to be sort of always out of date. Yeah.
So what was the answer?
What was the answer? The answer was, in fact, E, that we're going to need to do all of them. Because we need to build X because X is out of date in the traditional sense, and then we need to build Y because Y doesn't exist, so it's definitely out of date. And then we need to build W because X and Y just got updated. Yes?
What is checking the prerequisites?
Question, what is checking the prerequisites? Does it always read from left to right? I do not actually know. I think the answer is probably it depends, because make supports parallel building. Yes, back there.
I guess the advantage of this, so let's just suppose that X was cool and he was good too, and X was already up to date, then when it says W, X, and Y, it wouldn't need to rebuild the X, and it would just, if Q was up to date, would it like or something, or is this, we're doing this because sometimes a dependency is fine and we don't have to recompile everything?
So the question is, is this a scenario where we wouldn't always have to run all these commands, depending, sometimes they will be fine? Yes. So if I have different modification times, I could easily come up with a scenario where the answer is none. Yeah.
So the reason you have to build X is because Y doesn't exist.
There's two reasons I have to build X. The reason I have to build X is because Q doesn't exist, because Q is older. So if we look at X, X only depends on Q, but Q is older than X. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah.
If I'm understanding this correctly, if W has a more recent edit time than X and Y, then you will update X and Y to be the most updated version, and then you will run W's command.
Question, if W has a more recent edit time than X and Y, that did not factor in here at all. So the reason why we had to build W is that when it came time to figure out whether W was up to date, we had just updated X and Y. What we do is we say, I want to see if W is up to date. The thing I do before I check times is I make sure X and Y are up to date first. So we did that process, and after that process, W was in fact older than X and Y. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
What if Q didn't exist?
In that case, I believe we would try to make Q, and I think we just run build X, assuming we need to all the time. Even though I believe that's make we'll just always run build X if Q doesn't exist. Yeah. Did I say Q is older than X? X is older than Q, written in here. Okay, other questions? I'm gonna try to, there's something I want to cover for the lab tomorrow, so I'm gonna cut off some questions. So something you'll commonly see in makefiles is that we'll have targets whose only purpose is to depend on other targets. So a very common thing you'll see is a target called all. Let's say I have something where I have multiple programs and a library I want to build, which is something you'll encounter in lab. And I'll have an all target so I can run make all as a shorthand from the command line for typing all the names of the programs and libraries we could build. And there's no file called all. Another common one of these targets is that often we'll have a target called clean to remove files that were generated. A common reason for this is to force things to be recompiled if something was updated in a way the makefile doesn't understand, or just to save space. And this mostly just works. We have a target called clean with no dependencies. When I run make clean, there's no file called clean, so it's just going to run that command. Problem is, what if I make a file called all or clean? That kind of messes this up. And it messes this up because then that will mean that if I type make clean and there's a file called clean, it might not run that command anymore. That would be bad. That's not the intention of that. Something that make has to support this is you can mark rules as phony, meaning these don't correspond to real files, don't check modification times for them. Just they're shorthands from the command line, so I can type make all to specify this kind of these other things, make clean to specify just run this command no matter what.
And there's kind of a common set of targets you'll see if you look at like software distributed with makefiles. So all, which is usually the first one, is like build everything. Clean is usually clean up files that were generated while building to save space. Sometimes it'll be install or test target. And these typically won't be building files called install or test. They'll just run some commands that install or test. Okay, so questions about our standard targets quickly? Okay. So one other thing that comes up in the examples here is that there's lots of redundancy. I've had sort of all this stuff where it looks really annoying to change these makefiles because I've kind of repeated myself a whole bunch of times. Like, what if I don't want to pass wall? I want to pass epsilonitize equals address wall. Seems like I have to change a whole bunch of things here. If I want to change playing the GCC, I have to change a whole bunch of things. So make supports variables or macros, depending on whose documentation you're reading, for kind of having a shorthand here. So I can specify, let's use CC as a shorthand for GCC, C flags as a shorthand for WWAL, pedantic, standard equals C11. Those are the flags I like using. And I can just have them used in my commands, and make will do a text substitution for me. And it also turns out I can like override these on the command line, and also I can edit these in one place in my makefile if I want to change them. And these names I'm showing aren't a coincidence. These are the conventional names you will see in pretty much all software that uses makefiles, CC for the name of the compiler, C flags for the options to it, and so on. So another form of redundancy I have here is that like I've written main.o twice, I've written program twice, I've written an extra.c twice, and extra.o twice. I can avoid that too. There are these implicit variables that correspond to the current rule I'm in. So I can use $& is the target of whatever rule I'm in. $less than is the first dependency of the rule. And $up arrow is all the dependencies. So using that, I can avoid more redundancy, so I can just have things specified in my rule and in my commands. Rather than retyping all the .o files I listed, I just say, use all the dependencies. Copy those into the command line for me. Okay. So questions on these variables? Yeah. So question on the bottom, I mentioned that all these dependencies aren't portable. So in this class, we're basically going to be assuming GNU make or things that are compatible with it. This is the make you will find on Linux, on OS X, but it's not all versions of make. And there's one other thing we're going to talk about, which is probably our last topic. That's another thing that unfortunately is only in GNU make. There's something similar that's more portable, but it's, in my opinion, a lot less nice to explain, and it's in the reading if you want to look it up. But yes, so make is standardized by POSIX, but the POSIX version of make is not usually what people are targeting in make files. Because the POSIX version of make doesn't have some features like this $up arrow that a lot of people, that are very useful to have. And there's some other minor differences that mostly don't come up, but you might encounter in practice. Other questions? Okay, so I have this aside, make version. So except for the $up arrow, everything we've talked about so far works in every version of make you'll find anywhere. We're going to talk about one thing that is useful, that there's a less elegant thing that is more portable, but I'm not going to talk about because you don't see it used very much, and you can look it up if you need it. So we're going to talk about something called pattern rules. So something you might notice here is that these two rules here for extra.o and main.o are basically the same. It'd be sure nice not to write them both twice. And in fact, we can do that. We can write this one rule here that says to make a .o file from a .c file, run this command, and then we can separately specify the dependency part of the rule, and they'll get merged together So we'll specify the command for all the .o files made from that C files and the dependency separately. So questions? This idea, so this is a pattern rule, and basically this percent sign represents a wild card. It can be any file that matches that pattern will have. Question back there? Yeah. Question, we have this dependency on extra and h, but the pattern doesn't have that. Yes, so these sort of are merged with the pattern rule. So basically, make's going to find all the applicable rules and put them together. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. In my last minute, there's one more thing I'd like to say. So if you look at this rule, like this rule like seems like it's really useful for a lot every time you're writing a C program. And in fact, it's so useful that it's built into make. So I can write a make file where I don't even specify that rule, and it just exists already. Make has it built in. Because in the lab, we want you to write your know how make works, you're not allowed to use built-in rules. But in the real world, yes, make has this built in because what you know, make knows how to compile C files to .o files for you. We want to, you to know, you to demonstrate that you can like handle the cases where it doesn't know how to do that sort of thing in the lab. So that's where I'm going to finish off today. I'll be down here for questions and see you at lab, see some of you at lab tomorrow.